A priest, a politician, and a clown walk into a bar.
The bartender says,
"What is this, some kind of joke?"
"Politics, not funny. And not a comfortable subject these days, but if we ignore it, it's at our peril."
So get to know another candidate to represent the Springs area in Congress, Joe Regan.
Next on Loving the Springs, where we celebrate the best of Manitou and Colorado Springs and elevate the rest.
This is Studio 809 Podcasts, informing, connecting, and empowering the residents of the Pikes Peak region.
I'm Dave Gardner.
I'm Carrie Simison.
And I'm Al Brody.
We're recording this episode on April 17th in the Studio 809 Community Podcast Studio at The Next Us. Can you hear that? That's the entrepreneurial vibe permeating the place. We're all ages, all stages, all walks of life, bringing our individual contributions to the local community in downtown Colorado Springs.
In this episode, we're visiting with a very nice guy, Joe Regan. Joe hopes to win the Democratic primary June 30th so he can face off against the Republican incumbent, Jeff Crank.
Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me here.
How's it going so far?
It's always a great question, right? You ask any candidate that, and if they're telling you anything other than, well, I wish I had more money, more volunteers, and more time, then they're lying to you. So pretty much any day, I always describe it. I say, remember when you were in high school? And when you took that test, and if you felt like, yes, I aced this test, and then you get like a D. Or you walk out of that, man, I really bombed that. Like, I don't know why I bombed it, but I bombed it. And then you get like a solid A minus. I'm kind of in that mode right now where I'm like, I don't know where we're going, but hopefully it's going to wind up a solid A minus.
The only thing certain is uncertainty.
That's right. That's right. But it's exciting. I mean, I think we don't talk enough about how being a candidate for office gets you out into the community. And as someone that's been very, very involved with Colorado Springs, between my kids and my work in the nonprofit space, you know, even as a candidate, I continually find myself pushed in these new spaces to be able to interact with more of our friends and neighbors. And that has been a really cool experience for me.
What made you decide to run as a Green Party candidate? Just kidding.
So I'm running as a Democrat because the Democratic Party has always had its roots in supporting working class Americans. And one of the things that I've seen through the work that I've done in the nonprofit space has been that we have all of these tough problems that exist across our community. We talk about homelessness. We talk about veterans affairs and healthcare. And as a nonprofit leader, me and my colleagues have always been kind of on that forefront of we're the ones that are actually out there solving it. So when you look across Colorado Springs, there are so many amazing, smart people that have those solutions that we're implementing in our own community. But then those in Washington drawing policy aren't listening to those people. It's not those voices that are being elevated. And so being able to bring that perspective to policy, and I know that we talk about charity and nonprofits, and we typically think of all the nice things that we do. But I look at, like, my first nonprofit job was with Easter Seals, a national organization. Most people, it's been around for over 100 years. And this was an organization that, through its lobbying efforts, was able to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so I think that when you look at the roles that I've held as a nonprofit leader, it's been in that space of writing out policy, working with stakeholders to make sure that we're building out those programs that can actually solve the needs of communities. And now, as a candidate for Congress, taking that same experience and now being able to translate back to, these are the voices that we need in Washington. These are the things that we need to be doing.
It's no big secret that both parties are fracturing at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats, I'll speak for them at this point, there was a vote in Congress about supplying bulldozers and bombs in a foreign military sale to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
40 Democrats vote one way, 7 Democrats vote the other way. Which way would you have voted?
Yeah. You know, and the Israel question is something that has really divided the Democratic Party. And I look at this the same way I hope that our European allies are looking at us right now. Right? Benjamin Netanyahu and the way that his government has pursued its policy has been the antithesis of Israeli values and American values. Just as Donald Trump is leading in a way, and I wouldn't even call it leadership, but he is ruling in a way that does not align with American values. And so I look at that and said, no. We should not have taxpayer dollars going towards Israel and providing for an administration that has pursued a number of policies in illegal wars now that Benjamin Netanyahu has even been brought on war criminal charges, to be able to bring that up. This is not something that American taxpayer dollars should be going towards. At the same time, looking forward, just as I hope our European allies are looking forward for us, there is a space where Israel can continue to be a constructive ally, but not under the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu. And we have an obligation as members of Congress who hold the power of the purse to make sure that our foreign policy and our foreign assistance are consistent with American values. What Benjamin Netanyahu is doing is not in that scope. We should not be funding it.
Now, don't get the impression these are all going to be softball questions.
Nobody ever asks me what my favorite color is anymore. It's like, you know, where can we have those softball questions? But even my kids ask me difficult questions these days about politics, but it's good.
But here's an easy one. Okay. So let's back up and tell us where we are in the process for the Democratic Party to decide who is going to face off against Jeff Crank.
Yeah. You know, 2-year cycles for congressional seats, for the House seats. So 2 years ago, after losing to River Gassen by less than 500 votes in a Democratic primary, pretty much from the beginning, I knew I was going to run again. And of course, I threw my support behind River and I did everything that I could to promote her candidacy. And at the end of the day, voters decided to put Jeff Crank in because he deceived voters. He ran as a moderate and has now been in Congress representing as a staunch Trump ally, where every vote that he has made has been consistent with Trump's agenda, even when it hurts our community. So over the past 2 years, we've had a number of people that have come in the race. They've come out of the race. We've had people that have come in. But consistently, for the past over 2 years now, I've been out there building the coalition that is needed to win and flip this district. Because like you said, to win in this district, this is not just about the Democratic Party. It is you have over 50% of unaffiliated voters in this district who view both parties as not truly representing their interests in any sense. And so to win in a district like ours, it's about how do you build a coalition of people from our community that actually want to get behind a candidate. And I think the thing that we struggle with when we talk about unaffiliated voters is you might be unaffiliated, but you have a lean. And I'm going to finish answering the question here. I know I've gone way off track.
I think I can figure out where you're going. It's a good answer.
And this is where you have that component of, right? So many people will sit there and say, well, I don't like this person, but I don't like that person either. And so I'm going to vote instead for the lesser of two evils. And we see that time and time again. And so what we've really tried to build this strategy around is building that coalition of folks that say, yes, I want to vote for that person, for Joe Regan, because he's out there, because he's someone that is vested in this community and has those direct ties. And along that path, so like I said, prior to the Democratic caucus, which was about, probably 3 weeks ago, that was that first step. We were able to push out those candidates, and now there's two of us. And so myself and another are now vying for the Democratic nomination to represent this district. And that election will happen in June. So you'll get your ballot probably somewhere on the second week of June. It'll be due back by June 30th. And then we'll find out who's going to take on Jeff Crank.
And we can say the name. It's Jessica Killen. So you and Jessica emerged from the party process, and one of you two will be selected in the Democratic primary.
That's right.
Congratulations to both of you, by the way. You deserve it.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think, you know, caucus is its own animal. We're talking about 600 well-informed, well-engaged voters, and there's a story to be told there. But now it's about expanding that story, expanding that coalition into the fact that we'll probably have somewhere between probably 40 to 50,000 people that are going to vote in this Democratic primary, which includes unaffiliated voters.
And I almost think I hear you saying, well, stop saying Democrat so much. If you could win the race as an independent, you almost could be an independent. Is that sort of what you're saying?
I don't know if I'd go that far. I mean, okay. I'm proud to be a Democrat. And I'm proud to be a Democrat because of the history of the party supporting working class Americans, right? The Democrats have always been the party of supporting our unions, supporting working class Americans, supporting rural Americans. And in part, one of the, I think, more philosophical sides of my campaign has always been this idea is if you look at policy and you look at how blue states manage policy and the outcomes that they have, there's some great articles that are out there by some prominent political scientists that talk about this fact that blue states are actually living red state values. And it's somewhere along the line, the Democratic Party lost that narrative of we're supporting all working class people, not just this group or that group. And sometimes our rhetoric gets in the way of ourselves of making that broader appeal to saying, listen, if you support major corporations and the top 1%, vote Republican. They've got your best interest in mind. But if you're not making over $1 million a year, the Democratic Party are the ones that are supposed to be there for you. And I know that there's certainly plenty of leaders that have lost sight of that in the Democratic Party. So I'm running because I believe in what the Democratic Party stands for and has stood for. But I'm also recognizing, as you said, that the party is also facing that same leadership crisis. 20% of Americans believe that the Democratic Party can actually bring forward realistic solutions to solve their problems. That's problematic. And that's where, when we look in a district like this, we've really got to dig into that. It's not just saying, I'm a Democrat, so therefore I'm not Donald Trump, you should vote for me. That's not going to win here. We really need to lay out that vision of this is what we stand for, this is what we're fighting for, and this is how we see that impacting our community here.
So we see a divide now, I'm switching topics just a bit, between President Trump and the Pope. And I don't think anybody really expected that type of vitriol that's coming out of almost both of them. This passionate feeling that it's right, it's wrong. And how do you keep that type of crap out of discussions with people that most of us actually revere as the best people on the planet?
Yeah. You know, and I was raised Catholic. And so, you know, being raised in a Catholic household, I was an altar server when I was in high school. You know, we talk about the values, and living up to those values, I think, is the biggest piece. And one of the things that I've seen consistently with, and go back to my statement of blue states live red state values. And that when you look at the fact that the Republican Party has brought on and really incorporated into its coalition the religious right on this premise of, oh, well, we are, you know, this is about, you know, God and country. Well, but then you look at the Democratic Party and say, well, but if you go back to the Sermon on the Mount, right, Jesus tells us pretty explicitly, right, take care of the poor, take care of the weak, take care of the imprisoned, like all of those people. That's where policy really comes into play of saying, hey, we are the ones that are actually promoting policies that are in line with these teachings and these values. And to be inclusive of other religions, to look at the fact that this is not something that is unique to Christianity or Catholicism. I mean, you look at Islam and Judaism, and those same values are there. And when we talk about American values, it is embedded in some of those teachings of saying, hey, we believe in taking care of our neighbor. We believe in making sure that people aren't just left out to rot. We want to make sure that we have those abilities so that people can be taken care of, because as human beings, we want to see our neighbor cared for. And I think where Republicans have tried to drive that wedge is that typical demonizing these people of like, oh, these aren't people in need. These are people that are misusing your resources. But if you go out and talk to folks, you'll see that that is like, we are all, almost all of us, one crisis away from being unhoused ourselves. And that is the reality that most middle-class families are facing today, is when you look at how many people are falling into medical debt, how many people are unable to keep up with bills because of inflation. These are things that people are driving towards, and you recognize the fact that, yeah, if you're a middle-class family right now, which is most of us, you are one crisis away from being right out there on the street with these same folks. And if you can't recognize that, then you're not paying attention to what's really happening.
So let's hear a little bit about your history in Colorado Springs.
Sure. Yeah. So I moved here in, it would have been early 2020. And so, you know, when I left home when I was 18 and went to college, I joined the military, and I've moved all over this country. I did two tours in Afghanistan in 2006 and 2009. One of those was a 16-month tour. And I will tell you that Afghanistan is not the shortest place that I've ever called home. So, you know, between the time that I was 18 and 40, spent a lot of time moving around the country. And really, when it came time to say, you know, listen, I'm tired of just moving for jobs and moving from place to place, I really want to find a place where I can settle down, raise my kids, put them in a public school system where they can have roots here. And that's exactly what we did. When I found out that it was like, nope, Colorado Springs is the place. And I had a buddy that was stationed at Fort Carson. We came out and spent about a week with them and their kids. And I was like, yep, this is home. This is where I want to be. And at the time, I was a director at a national nonprofit called Reach Across America. I had been doing a tremendous amount of advocacy work for veterans' mental health and to support military families, especially when COVID heated up. It was a big deal to be able to get out there and to make sure that people knew the resources that were available and to provide those opportunities to connect, even though we had been socially distanced, right? We had to find those ways to keep that social component going. And that led me to a number of different organizations here. So I was very quick to join the Colorado Springs Rotary Club, partnered with Mount Carmel Veterans Service Center as a community ambassador because the work that they do is just absolutely incredible. And that has grown over the past now 6 years. The kids have really thrived in the school system here, and we've really seen this as a place that this is where our family belongs.
Awesome. Was there something particular that really stood out in that week you were visiting that made it feel like this was going to be home?
I don't think we're using video on this one, but if you look out the window, I mean, that is the attractiveness. And, you know, I went to college in Vermont at a small military college. And when I was there, I got into mountain rescue. And so I volunteered for the college had its own mountain rescue team and thoroughly enjoyed that. I've always enjoyed the outdoors. I'm a lifelong skier. I've been skiing since I was probably 6, 7, 8 years old, maybe. And this was just the place. And this might sound a little weird, but I'm going to serve with the 10th Mountain Division. And while, you know, currently the 10th is stationed out of Fort Drum, New York, you know, its history here in Leadville, there's something to that it just feels home. And I can connect to that legacy of the 10th Mountain Division and the troops that were here at Carson and then went out to Leadville and, you know, trained in those hills. And that is something that has just been part of it. And then the family aspect, right? Colorado Springs is a truly unique place in that when we look at over 94,000 veterans call El Paso County home, 5 military installations. And so as a veteran, it's also really easy to find people that can connect with me. And I know as a veteran, many veterans have difficulties feeling like they fit in communities that don't have that veteran population because our experiences are unique. Whether you served in combat or not, being in the military is a very, very challenging experience. And so to know that I can walk through and have somebody that gets me and gets what I've gone through, that's part of making this place really feel like home.
So we've got two candidates facing off to decide who will be the chief opponent to the Republican incumbent, Jeff Crank. And they're both pretty likable, you and Jessica Killen. Mm-hmm. We could do a lot worse.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like you are both very electable. But it is really critical for everybody to pick the one who can put an end to the Republican dynasty in this area, right?
Yeah.
Because we've never had anybody but a Republican represent us in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it you?
Why is it me? You know, and I would say this, and I think that there's always a challenge when you get into primaries of obviously we feel passionately about being that person. And I look at it and I say, listen, a primary is an opportunity to ask difficult questions. We need to ask difficult questions of ourselves and of our candidates because we have to have that opportunity to go beyond just a who do I prefer and who can win. And when I look at that, we have to ask those difficult questions of, you know, talking about the national level trends that we're seeing, right? We see tremendous distrust that exists across both parties. We see the fact that people are distrustful of these Washington insiders. And I think that in a district like this, and like we kind of opened with this conversation of you have people that are going to default to whatever that might be, you just say, well, I don't like that person. I don't like either person, but this seems like the safer option for me. And here's what's really interesting about this. We spend so much time talking about the 54% of El Paso County voters who are unaffiliated. Right, 16% of us are Democrats, registered Democrats. I think it's a little bit over 20% are Republicans. And then, like I said, that vast majority, strong majority, unaffiliated voters.
Yeah.
And I think where we get this wrong is when you talk to folks outside of El Paso County, we have this notion of, well, an unaffiliated vote, that's a single voting block. And that's not the case. And if you've been here for a while and you look at voting habits of people, and I'm going to use the last election as an example. Right, so you had on the ballot, you had River Gasson, you had Kamala Harris, and then we had these two ballot initiatives. We had marriage equality and we had women's reproductive freedom on the ballot to enshrine those freedoms into our state's constitution. 54% of El Paso County voters voted in favor of the women's right to choose. 42% voted for the pro-choice candidate, the Democrat that was running as a pro-choice candidate. And so you have over 12% of those voters that stood up and said, I'm pro-choice, but I didn't vote for the pro-choice candidate. 47% voted for Kamala Harris. So same thing. A notable difference of people that said, this is what I believe, but I'm not voting for the candidate that represents that. Mm-hmm. And to dig into the why. And I do think that comes down to a couple of issues that we've already talked about, which is one, how do we as Democrats connect with those kitchen table issues of voters here in El Paso County? Making sure that we're making that vision and laying it out of like, hey, here's how national policy translates into El Paso County. Look at how Jeff Crank has voted against supporting Space Command staying here. And understanding what his motivations are and why he has done that. Or look at the fact that he voted against Lauren Boebert's water bill to bring clean water to Coloradans. And the fact that that's something that when we look at, I haven't read the details of the bill, but if Lauren Boebert wants to work on clean water for Colorado, I'm all in. Because look at some of our folks down in Fountain and Security and Winefield that for years have seen the toxic poisoning coming off of Peterson that have been poisoning and seeping into their water supply, right? That's one of those ideas. If this is that example of how do we work together to address those local issues and be able to do that. And that's the work that I've been doing in this community. And I think as a political outsider, it also sets me up to have that trust. Of voters don't see me as being part of the Democratic Party. They see me as someone that is local. They see me, you know, sure, our engaged Democrats know me as a good Democrat in this community. But other people see me as the guy they see in pickup line at school. The guy they see at the Little League field, the veteran guy that shows up to all these different events. And I think when you look at the feedback that we receive from some of, you know, we see online and questions that I receive when I'm out there, a lot of people are saying, well, you're everywhere. And I would say that, well, I'm everywhere because I'm part of all these different components. So go back to what are we trying to do by running for office? And it's who are the voices that we're going to surround ourselves with? Because I think that's something, and that leads to distrust of so often politicians, they go to Washington and they surround themselves with these folks that have always been in Washington, the lobbyists and the special interest groups, and they've lost sight of the fact that you're supposed to be back here in the community and making those connections. Let's also talk about constituent services, right? At the end of the day, your congressional office is supposed to be a place that you can go and get connected with resources. And so the same approach that I've taken in a number of different nonprofits, which is this philosophy of no wrong door. If you walk into my office, whether it's as a member of Congress or as a nonprofit leader, I view my role as saying, hey, if I don't do that, I should know who does and be able to make that connection. And that's where of any candidate, whether it's Jeff or Jessica, I've got far more knowledge of what's happening in this community than either one of them. And I think that's how you establish that trust, to have that separation of saying, hey, yeah, I'm a Democrat. I'm a proud Democrat. Here's why I'm a proud Democrat. But I am not part of the Democratic Party establishment. I am someone that has been a community leader, and I am leveraging on that experience to elevate new voices that have gone unheard in this community for too long.
Well, you just answered three of my questions, so I won't ask those.
So not too long ago, there was a State of the Union address. And
is that what that was?
That's what they call it.
What is the State of the Union?
Because that is required by our Constitution. Mm-hmm. And
I'm glad he's following at least one aspect of the Constitution.
Well, he was, but a significant number of Democratic congresspersons did not show up. Mm-hmm. Now, we are both veterans, and there's a thing called failure to go.
Yep.
I cannot rationalize not showing up to the meeting as a congressperson. How do you feel about that?
Another softball question from Al.
And it is. And so let me start by saying the Democrats that chose not to show up, I understand what they were trying to do. They were leveraging the moment and acknowledging the fact that this is a president who has nothing constructive to say or contribute to the conversation. At the same time, I feel like constituents want to see their member of Congress in the room. If you're not in the room to have the conversation, then we have surrendered that voice of the community. And I think that in some cases, Democrats that chose not to go found a different venue to elevate the voices of their constituents. And that's okay. But for me, I'm kind of sitting in the same boat. I would be there to at least be able to show dissatisfaction of, hey, I'm here and you are not representing the interests of my constituents. And that is not the right way to approach this.
Note for our listeners, high five.
So whoever is elected to Congress in 2026 will serve 2027-28 mm-hmm. under, I guess, the same administration we've got now.
We'll see.
Yeah, you never know, I guess. Why do you say that?
Well, I think for a lot of Americans and a lot of voters, even in El Paso County, right, a district that did go for Trump, that you have the opportunity, and keeping in mind that Trump underperformed against Jeff Crank as well. So 47% of voters went for Kamala Harris. So Trump had a much narrower margin here in El Paso County. So you have, in our community, a lot of voters that identify themselves as hardcore Republicans, but fundamentally disagree with the MAGA movement and what they do. And so what we're seeing today, and I always tell people, because the impeachment question comes up in almost every forum that we have. And, you know, the two concerns I have is, one, we don't want to elevate J.D. Vance any further. J.D. Vance has already been elevated well beyond his peak level of incompetence. And so we don't want to elevate someone like him into higher office. Also recognizing the hurdle that we face in securing not just impeachment, but removal from office. And that does require a supermajority in the Senate to be able to do that. And so we have three scenarios that come into play here, right? And I know there's a lot of excitement around the Democrats being able to retake a substantial amount of power in Washington back in 2026. And I assure you, a blue wave is not guaranteed. Anyone that tells you that the Democrats are a sure win to bring in a second blue wave, you are not reading national politics right. And that is why this election is so critical. It's not just about putting a Democrat that can run against what Donald Trump is doing. You need a Democrat that can create a vision to restore trust in not just elected officials, but the Democratic Party. Because Donald Trump is about 30% approval rating. The Democrats are somewhere around 20. And so this is the challenge. And when you look at polling even here, right, it is still going to be an uphill battle for someone to win against Jeff Crank. And so we have to recognize that. So you have three possible things that could happen in 2026. Could win and still be part of the minority party, where there's not going to be a lot of opportunity to really accomplish much unless you're really able to build a coalition to include attracting moderate Republicans that you're starting to see split off from the MAGA movement. So we see these fractions. And I talked about Lauren Boebert earlier with her water bill. And that's a great example of, hey, we don't have to agree on everything to work together. Let's find those single issues to be able to do it. And in the minority party, it's being able to navigate that space and finding the ways that we can put a check on this administration. We've seen congressional pushback on cabinet members like Pam Bondi, like Kristi Noem, and they are no longer in office because it was clear to Democrats and Republicans that they were not executing the duties of the office that they were appointed to, that they were not leading in a way that is consistent with our constitutional values. And so building out that case as well, there is a scenario where we do retake the House, but that Senate battle is still uphill. And so you could face a split Congress where you have a democratically controlled House and a Republican-held Senate. And in that case, it's the same thing, making sure we put together legislation that is actually going to cross the 60-vote hurdle that exists in the Senate. And then I think it is a chance, but it is going to be a hard fight to secure the 60 votes needed in the Senate for the Democrats to overcome a filibuster. And I think that that's when we talk about how do we now put in guardrails around these other things. And we can be able to do that and constrain any further damage from this administration by focusing on how do we bring back power that the Constitution has already laid out, right? Mm-hmm. The president does not have the ability to declare war. He does not have the ability to tax Americans unilaterally. And do not kid yourself, the tariffs that this administration has illegally put on Americans is the single largest tax increase in the history of our country. Americans have never been taxed at a higher value under this administration because of the tariffs and the way this administration put them in illegally. And so we see this so often in policy that we rely on precedent and historical norms to drive our decision making, and we can't do that anymore. We have to have members of Congress that go forward and lay out those guardrails in a way that's going to constrain this administration and future administrations. Is impeachment on the table? Yes. But unless we can get the votes needed in the Senate to actually remove him from office, and Vance and others, then focus on strengthening the guardrails that we have, go back to affirming what the Constitution says we're supposed to be doing, and have Congress that actually is doing its job and holding the executive branch accountable.
Recently, a few years ago, the Trump team figured out that the popular vote really isn't important. It's the Electoral College, mm-hmm. and they worked that. And now there's the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. The whole idea is that you get a number of states that come together and they'll say, well, if our popular vote goes in one direction, then we will use our collective electoral votes in order to help sway the broader, the election math that we see, the Electoral College math. I will tell you, I really struggle when we make those sorts of fundamentally systematic changes to the way that we vote. And when you look at the reason that the Electoral College was created in the first place, was to be an additional check on the parties, in a way, to prevent them from pushing forward an agenda and becoming a tyranny of the majority. And so I do feel like, do we need to relook the electoral process? Yes. Do we want to fundamentally change the way that we have this and so that we're modifying the way that the Electoral College operates? I always worry, and same thing with the filibuster. And you're seeing Republicans make this case for us today where they're saying, well, no, we're not going to change the filibuster, because if we get rid of the filibuster and the Democrats take power, well, then we're going to do the same opposite. And so I would look at folks that say, I say, I understand the argument as to why we're doing that, but recognize that 4 years from now, or now 6 years from now, it might be the Republicans that do the exact same thing and use that against us. So when we make those sorts of systematic changes, Supreme Court is another one. You know, do we restock the Supreme Court, right? Mm-hmm. Recognizing the long-term impact of what that might look like, that is something that requires tremendous thought in how that actually gets put into practice. And so that's one of those things. What I would tell you is, when it comes to changes to how we run elections, you know, you look at states of like Alaska and even Louisiana that use ranked choice voting. Mm-hmm. As an opportunity to bring in candidates. This is one of the challenges. And I love talking about Mitt Romney and his presidential run. You know, Mitt Romney really tried to run as a Utah Republican and lost, because he was a Utah Republican and lost the appeal of being nationally electable. When you look at Mitt Romney being one of the more popular governors of Massachusetts, the governor responsible for implementing RomneyCare, which of course became the model for Obamacare, mm-hmm. that's somebody that should be nationally electable, because you have a Republican that got elected in a deep blue state and was popular there.
Yeah.
And so Democrats, we see this too. We have those leaders in red states that have figured out this electability. Andy Beshear is a great example. Won in a deep red state as a Democrat because he made that case of, this is why the Democrats are the better fit for our community. And this is what that looks like. And so I think the challenge to parties, and even those of us that participate in presidential primaries, is thinking through not just a, this is what I want. And I know it's important to vote with our conscience. I'm not saying vote against your conscience, but also think through, who is truly electable at the national level and what does that look like? And this is where I think party leadership has a role to play in not putting their thumb on the scale, which we've seen as well, but to make that case as to, hey, as a party, this is what we need to win. These are the candidates, in a broad sense, that we need to win. And that's what gets lost. And I think when you look at the ranked choice voting, it provides that opportunity to narrow down that field and give voters more options to force a candidate towards a place where you're actually able to gain a majority of the votes. And so look at Maine's 2nd Congressional District is a great example. I can't remember the exacts, but it went for Trump by over 10 points. Jared Golden, a Democrat, has won that seat consistently for, I think, probably 6 consecutive cycles, and has been very popular in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. And again, that's not an ideological alignment. It's simply saying, hey, you see these spaces where Maine uses ranked choice voting in its congressional elections, and you've seen that as an opportunity to make that broader appeal and to get those candidates that actually have that broad majority that can win Whereas when you just have that this or that, and we see those voters that will default back to that. Well, I don't like either of these people, so I'm voting for the lesser of two evils. Ranked choice voting kind of negates that.
So you like ranked choice voting?
I do. I'm very upset that it did not pass in the last election. I thought that would have been very valuable.
And you think that's a better solution or a part of the solution to this electoral college?
I think it's part of the solution. And keeping in mind that it is up to each state to run their own elections. And we're seeing that play out right now with the passage of the SAVE Act. We don't want the federal government involved in our elections, especially here in Colorado, where we have the safest, most secure, and accessible election processes than anywhere else in the country. We are the gold standard of voting. Every one of us is going to get that ballot in the mail. It is tracked. We know exactly where it is. You know exactly where it is. And it's reduced so many barriers so that people can get their voice heard. I think those are the sorts of things. States are the ones that are responsible. But if you believe that we need greater representation and that the national popular vote is not reflecting what's happening, I think we have to look at candidates. We have to figure out why they're not winning on a national scale and why they're not appealing to some of these communities that for long times were Democratic strongholds. Mm-hmm. The Midwest was always a Democratic stronghold, but then it became the Rust Belt, and you had these people that were put off by those views. They felt like the Democratic Party abandoned them, and now these states have shifted to be strong red, despite the fact that Republicans are doing everything they can to turn around and hurt those very voters that are putting them in power.
Let me ask you this. We have the ability to register all males for the draft.
Yep.
And we're going to do that starting soon.
Yep.
Automatically. Mm-hmm. They happen to be 18 years old, the same age that is the age to vote.
Yep.
Why not just do the same mechanism and register everybody to vote? I don't understand. It seems so simple.
And this is where, in Colorado, where you can, as soon as you get your driver's license, I mean, even we're registering 16-year-olds to vote. They can't vote, but they're put on the voter rolls as soon as they get that license. And I do believe that however a state chooses to do it, you know, to make sure that we're encouraging that voter access. I'm really proud of the fact that my campaign went out and got certified to be able to register people to vote. Mm-hmm. And then we immediately turned around and went onto our college campuses here in El Paso County to engage directly with young people to say, hey, listen, you might not agree with me as a candidate, but you need your voice heard. You want to know why young people are fed up with politics. They're like, well, nobody listens to us. Well, you don't show up to vote. Show up to vote and people will care. And that's, I think, one of the biggest problems. And I'll use this as a pivot to Citizens United, because this is part of that problem. Is with Citizens United, I think most of us fundamentally know that having dark money and international influence onto our elections is a bad thing. But let's also look at the fact that even the way that we look at this, our race here is being looked at, of saying, hey, your voice doesn't matter. Money matters more. And that's what we're paying attention to. We're not paying attention to the fact that, hey, your voice matters. And where Democrats have been most successful, and when Democrats truly bring change, is not when we focus money and big checks. Democrats are able to accomplish amazing things when we focus internally, we mobilize the people, we make the case, and we use our voices to influence that change.
So, slightly different. Will there be debates between you and Jessica?
I hope so. And again, I think that when we put candidates into the public forum, that is exactly what the expectation should be. Give people the chance to hear us side to side. I know there's at least, I have one on my calendar right now, and I would be open to do as many as if you want me to show up, I'll be there.
I like both of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really difficult. And we've interviewed Jessica mm-hmm. also.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people start to understand the nuances,
yep.
which there are nuances, but you're both solid candidates, and I feel great about that.
You know, and I think one of the interesting things that I find, too, is voters are losing interest in those two-minute sound bites. Right? There's only so much you can get across in a two-minute sound bite. And so in a Democratic primary, it can be really frustrating. Because in 2 minutes, there's only so much that I can relate to you. And then I'm also trying to balance the idea of, well, do I want to make the emotional appeal? Do I want to tell a story that relates to this? What do I actually want to communicate? That's a whole lot to squeeze into 2 minutes. And voters recognize that, and they want the nuance. And where platforms like this are really valuable is the opportunity for folks to not just hear the two-minute soundbite. Are you for or against this? You know, raise your hand if you're going to support that. But really get through, because as a member of Congress, you're one vote of many. And so it's got less to do with a, are you for this or for that? It's how do you think about these issues? Because when you actually have to implement policy, it's not about the vote. It's about the compromise that goes into the bill that gets to the vote. And I think that that's where forums like this, you're able to show that nuance, to show that level of detail on those the issues and relate back to people. And that's where, again, go back to for over a year now, been recording monthly podcasts on different issues personally to be able to put that information out there. So it's not a 2-minute soundbite. You know, there's over 20, 30-minute episodes of me hitting everything from foreign affairs to Doge to healthcare that you can find that information out.
And how can...
You can go to Joe Regan's Conversations on YouTube, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Al, you get the last question.
I do. So... What is it that you love about Colorado Springs?
Oh, man, it's always a hard question because it's like every day it shifts a little bit. And I would say like today, what it's about 50 degrees outside right now, and we're expecting snow later this afternoon. And then on Sunday, it's going to be 70 degrees. As an avid skier and outdoorsman, I love the fact that I can experience all four seasons in the course of 24 hours.
Every day.
Yeah. People say, you know, oh, do you have hard winters in Colorado? I say, well, not really. I was like, you know, generally speaking, you're going to experience them all. And I think what makes our community special too is you look at our investments in public access to land. And how many of us, you know, truly value our trails and our public lands, whether it's city-owned land, whether it's open space, whether it's national park forest that's adjacent to us. That's the sort of things that we enjoy. And the follow-on question is usually, well, what do you do if you're not campaigning, raising kids, working? You know, that's when you'll find me out in the woods somewhere trying to reconnect with nature and enjoy that natural beauty.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Where do people go to learn more about you as a candidate?
Yeah, so you can go to reganforcolorado.com is the website. It's Regan for Colorado is the handle on pretty much every social media channel. We actually have a really strong Reddit presence. It's been a great forum to be able to connect with people and interact with voters too.
On what subreddit?
I think most of it is on the Colorado Springs subreddit.
Okay.
And then you can also go to our office. We have an office downtown at 111 East Las Animas Street. So you can just stop by, check in with the campaign team. I'm usually popping in and out. I've been sitting still for an hour. That's the longest I've sat still all day.
Thank you.
So far, anyway. It was mentioned that we have had Jessica Killen on, so I'll put a link in the show notes to her interview for anybody who missed it. Thank you for spending close to an hour with us here today, and we'll look for you in those debates or forums or whatever they decide to call them.
Yeah. And you can always, again, if you go to our website, there's plenty of events where we're meeting with friends and neighbors all the time, or if you are downtown, pretty much any day downtown, you're going to see me walking around, so...
And that's true. I have seen him walk around.
Well, and I've certainly bumped into you at every event I go to, so can't avoid this guy, which is a good thing. And the name of the podcast that you've been recording on your own?
It's Joe Regan Conversations.
We're not finished, and we want you to stick around for some important news stories. Next, we'll be talking with Hala Ershadi of the Pikes Peak Bulletin. But before we jump into that conversation, one news item that I thought we ought to quickly address is we did get a final result in the public voting to name the train for the Front Range passenger.
Coco one.
So Carrie, you won't be able to jump on Fred.
Bummer. I was really, really looking forward to jumping on Fred.
but Coco won, and in the very near future, we'll have an episode where we'll be talking with the general manager of the Front Range passenger rail district. So we'll talk more about that.
Joining us at the table is Hala Ershadi, managing editor of the Pikes Peak Bulletin.
The Pikes Peak Bulletin represents everything we value about local, independent journalism. Courageous, fearless, relentless.
The place we turn to for the news about community, sustainability, local government, small business, education, and more.
What stories are you working on, Hala?
Thank you for having me. Today, I have a couple things to talk with you about. One is the Union Printers Home, that historic building near downtown that the current owners are looking to turn into a hotel using urban renewal funds. And there is a neighborhood group that says that should come with a benefits agreement. And I also wanted to talk about the interview I had with Mayor Yemi Mobilade and his new chief of staff, his former rival in the mayoral election, Wayne Williams, and how they are working together now.
Oh, that sounds dull. We don't want to talk about that.
Oh, it's plenty juicy.
Yeah.
Who does that?
Yeah, I'm glad you're digging into that because I couldn't believe the headline when I saw it.
Neither could I.
Yeah, it's definitely raising a lot of eyebrows. Should we start there?
Why yes. not?
So the once rivals in the 2023 mayoral election, Mobilati and Williams are working together now. The previous chief of staff stepped down in February, and Wayne Williams is on for the next year as Yemi runs for re-election. So I talked with them about how it came to be that these once rivals are now a team. And what I heard is that even during the election and right after, they did a PSA, people might remember, that was circulating on social media where the two of them set the tone of working forward and cooperation. And what Mobilati said that Williams really brings to the table is a history of coalition building. And Wayne Williams is a longtime political figure. He was on the County Board of Commissioners, and his wife is on there now. He was the county's clerk and recorder, and he was Secretary of State during the Hickenlooper era, and he was on Colorado Springs City Council. So he's kind of got all the connections that a person could have. And Mobilati said that he is really looking for Wayne Williams to build coalitions. You know, there's some obvious political shifts that could occur, especially during a campaign season. And I asked the mayor how this would affect his campaign, if maybe some people that formerly backed Wayne Williams would now be backing him. And he said, and I quote, "Not once have we even had a conversation about his backers. To be honest, I don't even know who they are. Wayne knows as much as I do that things evolve, things change. I can't speak to even who his backers are, but that has never been a part of the conversation," which I thought was a really interesting thing to say. Although the chief of staff position is theoretically apolitical, nothing is truly outside of politics when you're working in city government. At least that is my experience. And people are people. I mean, our connections don't stop when we walk into the office. So I think it will be really interesting to see how this plays out. I'm talking with a lot of people right now, some officials, some observers, just members of the public, and hearing a lot of different opinions about this, which we're going to put into a part two after I've had time to read over everything and sort of decide what the main themes are. And so that should be out probably within the next few days. But I think it's just a fascinating move. And maybe, I think best case scenario, it's something that is a bit of a pilot program for how politics might work moving forward as fractures within the main political parties, especially I think the MAGA and non-MAGA Republicans, as we look to reorganize how we work together, maybe this is an example of what that might look like. But I think time will tell.
Well, I hope I'm wrong, but my first blush reaction to this was that it's all about being reelected, that this virtually guarantees that Yemi Mobilati will be reelected, having such a stalwart conservative person in his corner.
Unless it completely flops before we even get to the election.
In what way?
Inviting in basically not your enemy, but your opponent.
Yeah, but I mean, it was an opponent in that prior election. But, you know, a lot of people thought Yemi Mobilati would be a progressive mayor, and he hasn't turned out to be all that progressive.
And this would cement his not being progressive.
And yet he still has some appealing qualities to progressives. So he's going to pull some there. And with Wayne Williams, that might keep him from even having a strong conservative opponent, maybe.
Yemi proved himself as a collaborator. So to bring in another collaborator, somebody that can build, I think that he's doubling up on what he's strong at and inviting in a very different approach. I guess when I ran for city council, and this was 2005, what I learned, if there was one lesson, is that every community has a overbearing, let's say, a very powerful lobby of some industry. And here it's the development industry.
What?
It's true. It's true. And they will back. And I'm not just saying they here, in any community, they will back a candidate that is more beneficial for their industry. And I think Yemi was the other guy, and Wayne was backed by the developers.
Sure.
And now you've got a combination of the two.
I was beginning to have my doubts about Yemi Mobilati, and this sort of cements them for me. So I would be more likely to support another more progressive candidate now, knowing that Yemi would keep Wayne Williams in that slot. Because Wayne, I hope you will, or somebody, Hala, should kind of go back and compile a list of Wayne Williams' votes when he was on city council.
Yes.
Just to remind everybody of what he was for and what he was against.
Yeah, well, he is a lifelong Republican, and he does vote along conservative lines. I think that is a very good idea to go back and look at the vote record. Although I think they would say that he is not there to promote an agenda other than the mayor's. That was something he reiterated whenever we touched upon that. But again, time will tell, yeah. Right?
And the chief of staff, I mean, that's the city manager, basically, these days. Mm-hmm. Another reaction I had, and this is semi-tongue-in-cheek, is, well, I guess Wayne Williams can't get a real job. There's one more political plum that he hadn't picked yet, and that was this. And this is probably the highest paying of all of the public positions he's had. I don't know how much Secretary of State earns. Chief of staff earns a lot.
True. We don't have a city manager on purpose. We got away from that type of governing and went to a strong mayor. And I think the one thing that Yemi doesn't do well is be the strong mayor. And he's invited in somebody that's willing to be the strong mayor. And that concerns me.
Well, we'll look forward to more reporting from you on that.
Well, thank you. I look forward to bringing it to you. And the topic of developers came up, and that's maybe a good segue into the other story that I wanted to talk with you all about, which is the Union Printers Home and the development that is potentially occurring there if the owner's vision moves forward. It's a historic structure. It's a castle off of Union, right across from Memorial Park. And the current owners are looking to turn the four historic buildings, which is the main castle-like building plus three others, into overnight lodging and a hotel, although what specific hotel that would be is not yet decided. And this project is near to three historic neighborhoods, diverse working-class neighborhoods, Kalan, Knob Hill, and Hillside. And those community members have come together to look for a community benefits agreement similar to another community group that we've discussed in other episodes on the other side of downtown.
Mill Street.
The Mill Street Community Benefits All. They have so far not been successful in securing a community benefits agreement. And the Union Printers Home Community Benefits Agreement group has been, you know, watching that situation, learning from it. And I think they're going to take that into account as they work with these different developers who are doing the Union Printers Home.
Do you get the sense that these different developers are more inclined to provide a community benefits agreement?
That's not really clear to me. The owner that I spoke with was Susan Liupati. Certainly, she expressed openness and more willingness to dialogue than we saw perhaps with the situation with the Mill Street and Norwood Development Group. But again, I think time will tell, right? There's, I think, some promising initial conversations. I think everybody's feeling hopeful right now. And nothing's in writing at this time. So that's just another situation that we will watch and see what happens.
Urban parks with a significant body of water have tremendous value. And if you look at our city, the potential to gentrify Memorial Park's surroundings is high. And to me, that's the first step. I just envision you gentrify the printer's home to a hotel, and it'll just surround the park and drastically change the neighborhood that you described as working class. Do we want that? And does that neighborhood want that? It's an incredible place to be.
I mean, there's a real fear there that that is what's going to happen. And it's a reasonable fear because there is a predictable pattern of gentrification that tends to happen. And once again, we're seeing this big project with potentially significant impacts to the residents around it, using tax monies in the form of urban renewal dollars to do that project. And in both of the community benefits agreement situations that we've been covering at the Bulletin, they're both urban renewal projects. And the argument is, if you're using this public money, what about the public good for the people who actually live there?
Exactly.
And so far, the answer from the development community has been essentially tough luck. And, you know, as someone who identifies more with the working class, I really hope that somebody, some developer, takes the lead on setting a precedent of working with these community groups and coming up with a meaningful agreement, and that that will set a tone going forward. Because while these urban renewal projects do bring some real benefits, they also can come with some substantial losses that nothing can buy back. No amount of tax money is going to remake a community that formed over generations. Once that is gone, it is gone. And I hope we do not allow that to continue to happen.
But I wonder if anyone's been silently acquiring land around Memorial Park in anticipation of this.
Don't know.
I can't say that either, but I know that urban renewal zones are popping up all over downtown. So it does look like some substantial redevelopment is going to occur.
Sounds like a job for Pam Zubek.
Yes.
Yeah, she would be great with that.
All right. Well, I wish that we could just do a whole hour-long episode with you every time you come into the studio, Hala, because you always bring such interesting news. So I hate to cut it short, but we always have to cut it short.
Well, I appreciate you talking with me today, and I encourage everyone who listened to this to go to our website, pikespeakbulletin.org. We just refreshed it. It looks so nice now, much more readable and accessible. And check out our stories there. You can also sign up for our weekly e-newsletter and get the top stories of the week delivered to your inbox.
Ditto that.
Thanks for sharing your reporting, Hala.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, that's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening.
In the Pikes Peak region, there's no shortage of activities. Whether you're experiencing breathtaking parks or magnificent works of art, if you're getting fashionable at a film festival, or fresh at a farmer's market, if you want to hear the sweet sounds of a symphony or the smooth shred of a Stratocaster, look no further than Peak Radar, your one-stop shop for all events in the Pikes Peak region. Your free source for viewing and posting events. So no matter how you engage with our beautiful region, visit peakradar.com and get plugged into the peak.